This is Clinical Conversations. I'm Joe Elia, and my co-host, Dr. Danielle Schurer of the Medical University of South Carolina, is on the line. We're talking once more this week about PPIs, proton pump inhibitors, and their effects on hip fracture risk in postmenopausal women. Data from the Nurses' Health Study published in BMJ this week show that regular use of PPIs increases the risk and that longer-term use further increases it. However, the risks seem to be limited to women with a history, any history, of smoking, possibly due to a synergistic effect on calcium absorption. Our guests today are two of the study's authors, Dr. Hamid Khalili, a fellow at Massachusetts General Hospital, and Dr. Andrew Chan, an associate professor at Harvard Medical School. Welcome to Clinical Conversations.
Thanks very much. Thanks for having us.
Dr. Chan, how did your group get interested in this question? Is it part of a larger research effort by your group?
Well, as you probably know, and many of your listeners know, there has been a lot of discussion about the long-term use of proton pump inhibitors, and largely that's been related to concerns about, you know, this potentially being related to an increased risk of hip fracture. And several studies have shown this association, and we really wanted to see if that association was also something we could either confirm or refute based on our data. We've been working with the participants in the Nurses' Health Study for many years, and one of the things that we've come to really appreciate about our cohort is the really rich amount of data that the nurses in the study have provided us in terms of their lifestyle and diet. And so we thought this was a really unique opportunity to look at this question in this type of cohort, because one of the limitations of prior studies is really a minimal or a difficult time in sort of being able to account for these sort of factors for fracture in their analysis. So because we know these women have been basically offering us this data for quite some time, we thought it was a unique opportunity to take a look at the association of proton pump inhibitors and hip fracture in the context of these dietary and lifestyle factors that we know are important for fracture risk.
Interestingly, we actually, the interview that we did last week was looking at a study in children with PPI use in children with asthma, and essentially that showed that there was probably no evidence of benefit and that there were some evidence of harm. One of the things that they also looked at was fracture in children, which was also very interesting. And I just feel like the more of these studies that come out and the risk continues to accumulate it on PPIs, this is almost starting to become like very an uneasy feeling. Well, why do you think we're still using so many PPIs in so many patients? I mean, you mentioned in your study that between 2000 and 2008 alone, the prevalence of PPI use almost tripled.
This is Dr. Khalili speaking. I think I agree with you. Our cohort, if you look at the prevalence of PPI use in 2000, I think it was close to 5 to 6%, and then it went up as high as, I think, close to 16 to 20% in 2006. Mm-hmm. And, part of, I think part of that is obviously because of FDA approval of PPI as over-the-counter medication. In 2003 to 2004. That's one. And I think the other part is sort of use of PPI for indications other than acid reflux, you know, aka sort of functional dyspepsia, so on and so forth. And also use of PPI in the hospitalized patients in the setting of sort of concern for increased risk of GI bleed.
Yeah.
And especially you see a lot of these patients sort of getting discharged on PPI despite the fact that really the only indication for being on PPI was probably for a GI bleed prophylaxis.
Right.
So I think you sort of bring up a very important point, and one thing that we also wanted to focus in our study is to make sure that we continue to sort of monitor the indications for use of PPI and why are people on PPI, and is there really a continuous use for using PPI in such a large number of people in the U.S.?
And as you mentioned, your study is certainly not the first one to identify this association. But I was very impressed by your tenacity of slicing this in a number of different ways and really trying to validate your findings, including taking the Nurses' Health Study and combining it with previous studies. But really, it seemed to me, no matter how you sliced it, you really came up with very similar conclusions. So, I mean, it seems like we now really have a robust answer saying, you know, that there really shouldn't be any doubt left in anyone's mind that this association is real. Do you agree with that, or do you still have some lingering doubts on the strengths of the association?
So this is Dr. Cooley again. I'll talk about what I think, and then Dr. Chan might also share his thoughts. And you know, when we started this study, we really wanted to convince ourselves and also the audience of whether there's really a true link between long-term use of PPI and risk of hip fracture. And you know, we really didn't know what to expect. We sort of started this study hoping that, or expecting that maybe after accounting for all these dietary and lifestyle factors that other studies have not really accounted for, we won't see an association between regular use of PPI.
That maybe so, it would wash out, yeah.
Right, it would go away. So, you know, if you read this study, a lot of the analysis in the study is also for us to convince ourselves that there's really a true association. We did a lot of sensitive analysis, as you saw in the paper, and probably some of them didn't make it in this study. But I agree with you. A lot of this was for us to convince ourselves and also to make sure that whatever it is that we're reporting, we're also confident that that is really a reflection of the association between PPI and hip fracture, at least in our cohort.
Yeah, I mean, this is Dr. Chan. I think one of the real difficulties with any sort of medication study is that, you know, you do worry a lot about, you know, potential other factors that may be accounting for some of the associations that you see in the literature. So, you know, as Dr. Cooley mentioned, we really did try as best we could to try to account for why people were using PPIs and also try to, again, account for variation in lifestyle that is related to the use of PPIs that may account for the findings. And even when we really controlled for those factors as best we could using the really rich data we have, you know, the association persisted. So, you know, I think we are getting more convinced that maybe this association is a true biologic association.
Mm-hmm,
and I think you did raise the question, well, is the data now enough to really say, you know, we need to be worried and this association is strong enough that we should start to think more seriously about, acting on the evidence. It's difficult to say because, you know, we've been so accustomed to really wanting to see really gold standard level evidence for clinical interventions, i.e. we want evidence from randomized control trials. But as you know, one of the real difficulties in the field is that some of these adverse effects of drugs are still relatively rare outcomes, and so they require really large numbers of patients to really...
In absolute numbers,
To really pull out the effect. And also, you know, it sometimes requires really observing individuals on medications over many decades, and so it's really not possible or feasible to really get that kind of gold standard level evidence that we really would ideally like to have. So at this point, we are kind of left with the data as it stands, and I think if you really look at the consistency of the data across at least the observational studies, I think it does raise appropriate concerns for clinicians and enough of a concern that I think you start to wonder whether, you know, people should kind of appraise whether the use of PPIs over the long term, you know, needs to be more carefully scrutinized.
And you also found duration mattered. And interestingly, you found that those who had stop their PPI within 2 years, their risk seemed to be similar to non-users. So there was, in layman's terms, you sort of could wash away that risk by stopping them. Is that something that you did expect to find? And can you explain to our readers why you think that makes sense?
So this is Dr. Cooley. I'm speaking again. So I think the duration analysis primarily was done to sort of show whether there is sort of a cumulative effect, meaning that the longer and the more exposed you are to the medication, does the risk go up or not? It does help, you know, to some degree in terms of what is the biologic rationale behind this sort of link. Is it, you know, suppression of acid? Is it something else? So it does sort of help a little bit in that regard. But I think it also helped the clinicians even more that, you know, the longer somebody has been on PPI, the sort of higher the risk of fracture. It's also the time since discontinuation is also kind of nice because it sort of tells you that maybe the effect is really truly related to PPI, that, you know, when these people stop using PPI, the risk went away. And so it's probably a PPI effect as opposed to something else that might have been associated with PPI use.
Tell us a little bit more about what you found with smoking.
You know, one of the issues that obviously comes to mind when you look at all these studies is the risk that you see with PPIs something that is specific to certain subgroups of patients? Because obviously that makes the message a little bit more clear for the general population. And you know, it's logical that you would think that there would be potentially certain subgroups that may be at higher risk for developing these complications of PPI use. And one of the limitations of the studies that have been done so far is that their data on certain risk factors for fracture, such as smoking, was relatively limited. So one of the things we really wanted to carefully look at was to identify if there were particular subgroups of patients for whom PPI use seemed to be an especially strong risk factor. And one of the subgroups that did emerge from the study was folks that had prior history of smoking or were current smokers.
Mm-hmm.
And, you know, I think in terms of a clinical message, I think it does, you know, suggest that folks that smoke who are already at a higher baseline risk of having a fracture are potentially more at risk if they do take PPI. But then on a sort of more biologic level, I think the finding does raise the question about whether there is something synergistic about the effect of PPIs and smoking on hip fracture. Unfortunately, you know, there's very little in terms of our understanding of sort of how smoking maybe is a risk factor for fracture. So it does still require us to think on a more basic level about some of the mechanisms behind osteoporosis and fracture that have to do with smoking. But I think it does, you know, provide some insight into a potential shared mechanism. And, you know, insofar as, you know, the physiology of PPIs are somewhat worked out and, you know, some of the effects of smoking are also worked out, looking at the overlap between those two different pathways, I think, would be a fruitful area of future research.
So would it be fair to say then that the bottom line is, in terms of statistical significance at least, look out for PPIs if you have ever smoked? Or is there an added risk of PPIs that isn't dangerous, but it's still elevated until it's paired with a smoking history?
So this is Dr. Cooley speaking. So if you look at our data, just, you know, sort of trying to analyze our sort of our work here, among individuals who've never smoked, we actually didn't see an increased risk with regular use of PPI and hip fracture. However, if you look at individuals, as Dr. Chan mentioned, who have ever smoked, so either never in the past or currently, the risk was significantly higher. I think it was about 50% higher. So if you want to sort of make a conclusion based on our study by itself, you know, we did not see an association between regular use of PPI and risk of hip fracture among individuals who have never smoked. And it looks like the risk is confined to individuals who have ever smoked.
So people with a smoking history really have to be, are at increased risk for sure.
Right.
And that's a lot of people. It's probably, you know, a third of the population out there.
And, you know, really we alluded to it a little bit earlier, but I guess one of the other pieces of this story that, you know, seems a little bit disturbing in my mind is that these are available over the counter. So it's not even, you know, necessarily a conscious decision of risk and benefit that a physician will make, but we've left it in the hands of, you know, patients who may or may not be, you know, perfectly well informed of what the risks are. What are your thoughts on that, given that these drugs are now over the counter?
Yeah, this is Andy Chan. I think that the question of monitoring patients on PPI use is going to be an increasingly important one.
I think one
of the advantages, obviously, of having a medication that is by prescription is that, you know, patients at least periodically need to check in with their doctors, and I think that
right.
check-in does provide a window of opportunity for a clinician to really think about why their patient is on PPI and whether that PPI needs to be continued.
Mm-hmm.
The danger of having something purely over-the-counter is that doctors don't, or physicians don't, you know, necessarily keep track that well about of patients' over-the-counter medications. And so they can kind of lose track of the fact that some of their patients may be on these agents over the long term without a good reason. So, you know, I think that is an important consideration going forward as to whether, you know, there needs to be some assessment about whether over-the-counter medications like PPI need to have more scrutiny in terms of long-term unmonitored use.
I would, you know, once those things go over the counter, it's really hard to get them back, though, isn't it? I mean, there's a lot of lobbying, and I could imagine the FDA trying to say, you know, we think we want to take these things away from over the counter use. I think that the drug companies would fight that pretty strongly. However, it's probably good advice for clinicians, especially people who treat postmenopausal women with a smoking history, to ask after these things and to caution them about the use. Would that be a fair thing to do?
Yeah, this is Ahmed Khouli. I think I agree with you. And one other thing that I do want to mention is, and you know, you guys can correct me if I'm wrong, from my understanding is this, that the over-the-counter PPI use is only for a short period of time. In other words, on the prescription or on the on the medication itself, it is mentioned to not use it for longer than 5 or 7 days. So I don't know if that really adds much incentive for people to sort of go and see their physician if they continue to have symptoms despite while they go off of Prilosec or Omeprazole. But I think that's also something to note, that the over-the-counter Prilosec is there for a limited short period of time use. So it shouldn't. It you know, ideally, it shouldn't really apply here to our study where we're using it, where we were talking about long term use of PPI.
If they read and follow the label,
right? Exactly.
Right. As we all do.
As we all do. Yeah.
Right. All right. Well, Dr. Chan, Dr. Khouli, I'll let you get back to your work. I want to thank you for spending some time with us today and talking about your work.
Thanks for having us.
Yeah.
Thank
my pleasure.
You.
That was our 144th. All earlier editions can be found at podcasts.jwatch.org. We come to you from Journal Watch, whose website is jwatch.org. Clinical Conversations executive producer is Ador Yano. I'm Joe Elia. Dr. Danielle Schurer and I thank you for listening.